The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Hello and welcome to Short Circuit, your podcast on the Federal Courts of Appeals. I'm your host, John Ross. Joining me today are IJ attorneys Diana Simpson and Wesley Hoddit. We dedicate this show to the students at the Francis W. Parker School in Chicago. Those students just did a moot court on the Timms case, which recently was before the U.S. Supreme Court. The attorney who argued that case and won that case, Wesley, is here with us today. Wesley, can you share a few words for the students about the case, maybe a fun anecdote, a fun fact?
Oh, yeah, I'm happy to. Well, of course, I was just the lucky spokesperson for a team of people at the Institute for Justice that took this case on shortly after the Indiana Supreme Court's decision. And that decision held that the excessive fines clause in the U.S. Constitution does not apply in the state of Indiana. To my surprise, and I think to the U.S. Supreme Court's surprise, there were three other jurisdictions that agreed with that conclusion. And so the residents of those states just didn't enjoy any protection from excessive fines under the U.S. Constitution. We recognized that as wrong. We petitioned the court for cert, and they granted in June of last year. As you said, I argued the case in November of last year. And on February 20th, we got a unanimous reversal with all of the justices agreeing that, of course, the federal constitution's protection for excessive fines applies against the states. Now, you asked for a fun anecdote, and I think the best I can do is to tell people about how amazing Tyson Timms is. This is a guy who, although he's been through some really difficult periods of his life and has made some bad decisions, has since 2013 done everything that society has asked of him. You know, he pleaded guilty, he paid his fines, he served his time. And this case is about the secondary punishment of the police and prosecutors attempting to take away his vehicle, a $42,000 Land Rover that was only incidentally involved in one small drug transaction. And Tyson's gotten sober, and he gave me a sobriety token, a 5-year sobriety token that he was recently given. And I kept that in my pocket with me when I was at the Supreme Court just to remember what was at stake for him personally.
Can you tell us what happens next in the case?
Yeah, the case has been remanded to the Indiana Supreme Court. And it's up to them as to how they want to handle it now. Our first move was to go to the Indiana Solicitor General and say, hey, can we have the truck back? I mean, this is a 2012 vehicle. Its Blue Book value now is something like $18,000. And this particular vehicle has been sitting exposed to the weather on a lot for 6 years. So it's probably worthless. But they told us no. They want to continue to litigate to try to establish what the standard for excessiveness is. And if they want to dance, we can dance. So we submitted a joint briefing schedule to the Indiana Supreme Court. And in the coming months, we'll see what they want to do with the case.
Okay. Well, speaking of dancing, let's get on to the first case, which comes out of the Ninth Circuit, where the panel does a little dance on qualified immunity.
Oh, yeah. This is the specter of qualified immunity, which hangs over everyone's constitutional rights. This case is Jessup versus City of Fresno. And in it, the appellants allege that police officers in conducting the execution of a warrant seized not the $50,000 that they claim to have seized, but in fact an additional $151,380 plus another $125,000 worth of rare coins. And so the appellants sued under a statute called 42 U.S.C. Section 1983. It's effectively the statute that gives you a right to enforce your constitutional rights. And the doctrine of qualified immunity, as the Ninth Circuit explains, only prevents officers from violating your rights if it is clearly established at the time that they're alleged to have done so that they can't do the thing. And since it is somehow not clearly established that police can't steal your money, they let the officers off.
So run me through that again. The police do a search pursuant to a warrant. They take a bunch of money, but they only record a small fraction of what they actually took, allegedly.
Yeah, that's the allegation. I mean, it's possible that these people are either mistaken or lying, but it's also possible that the police stole $151,000 plus $125,000 worth of rare coins. The doctrine of qualified immunity is supposed to shield officers from personal financial liability for violating people's rights. And we call it qualified because you're supposed to be able to overcome it. But the reality is this doctrine has gotten to a point where you can almost never overcome qualified immunity. I mean, let's step back for a moment and think about what the practical holding here is in Jessup. A panel of the Ninth Circuit is saying, because no one's ever said that police can't steal your money, police can steal your money. And I wonder why they don't take the extra step of saying, but henceforth, let's be clear, they can't steal your money, so that the next time this happens, it will be clearly established.
Well, and that's one of the real awful things about qualified immunity as it currently exists, is that courts don't have to do that. They take this two-step analysis, whether it was unconstitutional and whether it was clearly established that at the time it was unconstitutional. And so courts are often skipping that first step and saying, well, it wasn't clearly established, so we don't have to answer the question of whether it was unconstitutional or not. And that just doesn't sit well with a lot of people because you can't advance the law that way. You're always going to have you could have a series of cases all about the same issue and the court just continuing to say year after year, well, it's not clearly established, so we don't actually know whether it's a constitutional violation or not. And in a case like this, it's insane because it seems intuitively obvious that it is unconstitutional for the government to take your cash and pocket it. Like that doesn't seem to be a disputable question of whether that's gross or unconstitutional, and yet it is.
Yeah, and Diana, don't you feel like the problem here is the Supreme Court's Pearson decision, which, as you said, tells courts that they can pick which of these two qualified immunity prongs they want to address and that they don't have to address both of them. I mean, Pearson should obviously be overruled, and we'd be in a much better place, I think, if courts were free to recognize what every American on the street would recognize, namely that police can't illegally steal your money.
Well, and one of the interesting aspects of this case is that the Ninth Circuit doesn't cite a 2017 decision that the Ninth Circuit put out called Brewster versus Beck. And in that case, the Ninth Circuit held that the Fourth Amendment applies to the entire time that the government possesses someone's property. And so in this case, an issue came up about whether the Fourth Amendment applies to just the initial seizure or whether it applies to that initial seizure plus the continued possession of the property. And so that is subject to a circuit split right now. And the Ninth Circuit has come out on the side saying that the Fourth Amendment applies to the entire time. And that case came out in 2017. And so that happened after the seizure of the cash in this case. And so it wouldn't have applied to make it clearly established that the Fourth Amendment applies. But you would think that the Ninth Circuit would have included a paragraph or something talking about that in this case, saying that, well, even if it didn't apply to the seizure that happened in 2013, it applies to all seizures starting in 2017 and going forward.
Yeah, ain't the law grand? This happened to one of our clients here at IJ. And he, Rustam Kazazi, in a case that we brought in the Northern District of Ohio, was carrying $58,100 that he carefully counted and banded and labeled. And after that money was seized by Customs and Border Protection, they reported having seized $57,330. Well, where did the other $770 go? The government said, well, we never saw it. And when we got to the point of wanting to depose police officers, they agreed to split that $770 with us, give the rest of the money back, and be done with it. I don't think it's beyond the pale that there are officers out there who are on the take. And I think that courts need to get serious. For the sake of the integrity of law enforcement, courts need to get serious about probing these areas.
Absolutely. And one question that really comes up when you start thinking about it is whether this was a seizure pursuant to a search warrant or not, because the warrant presumably requires that when the police go and take something, that they then transport it back to the evidence room or whatever police procedures in follow from that, rather than putting it into their pocket in the first instance.
Oh, it does. It says right here in the opinion that the warrant required them to retain it in their custody subject to the order of the court as prohibited by law,
So perhaps the question ought to be whether this was a constitutional seizure in the first instance. And I don't think the court really addresses that question at all.
Yeah, really what I if you sort of had to do it over again, I might also bring a criminal rule 41G motion arguing that the property seized has to be returned because there's no probable cause to hold it. And I mean, Mr. Jessup, if you're listening, petition for rehearing en banc.
The thing that's so perplexing to me about this particular case is there is kind of a wrinkle in qualified immunity law that says if the police or government's behavior is so unbelievably outrageous in a particular instance that it's clearly obvious that it's outrageous, that there doesn't actually need to be a clearly established law. So how is that not this case?
Well, the Ninth Circuit says that it isn't because there's a split in authority on whether this kind of conduct violates the Fourth Amendment's prohibition on unreasonable searches and seizures. I can't say that I agree with that, but that's the way the court has looked at the other precedent in this area.
I mean, I agree with you, John. I think that that doctrine applies here and that the panel really should have taken a stand on this. I'm surprised there wasn't at least a dissent. But there you have it.
Okay, well, hopefully this goes en banc. Let's move on to the next case, which comes out of the Eighth Circuit. Wesley?
Oh, yeah, this is a case that I've been following for some time. It's the United States versus $579,475 in United States currency, which, you know, listeners will recognize as a forfeiture case. This is the government proceeding in rem against the property rather than the person. And in this case, originally in 2018, a panel of the Eighth Circuit affirmed a district court decision that the trucking company that owns this money had insufficiently made a claim to the money by saying, hey, that's my money and I'm the owner, which is all that the admiralty rules. You know, one of the strange things about civil forfeiture is that they're governed by the admiralty rules. But the admiralty rules require you to make a claim that states what you're claiming and what your interest is in it. And so it is routine. I mean, our clients routinely will say, that money is mine. I am the owner. And that's normally deemed sufficient. But the Eighth Circuit back in 2018 said, no, we agree that it's insufficient because you didn't say where you got the money from. Now, a split of authority had developed prior to that. The Eighth Circuit panel felt that it was bound by a prior panel decision. And what's really interesting is that, you know, in 2019, just back on March 8th, the Eighth Circuit en banc, that is to say all of the judges of the Eighth Circuit, reversed the panel decision and said, no, we agree with the Sixth Circuit and the Seventh Circuit and the Fifth Circuit that all you have to say is what the rule says you have to say. And so this case reached the correct outcome.
Wesley, so in the normal course of a forfeiture, money gets seized, and then people who own that money have maybe 30 days or whatever the deadline is to say, hey, I earned that legally and I want to contest any potential forfeiture. And you're saying that's all the statute requires, but in this case, the government was requiring people to explain or even show how they came by that money legally, right? In the initial stages of the forfeiture, as opposed to that being something you worked out later over the course of interrogatories and maybe even litigation. What was the government's justification for that?
Well, I don't know that they had a justification other than they want to make it as hard as possible for people to contest forfeiture actions. I mean, the prosecutors probably believe in good faith that as they allege that this money is somehow connected to drugs. But the bottom line is, like, this is a trucking company that had nothing to do with the initial traffic stop in 2014. They had complied with the statute by saying, hey, that's our money. And as the Eighth Circuit en banc points out, there's a procedure for the government to ask questions about that at the initial stages of the litigation to say, well, where did you get it from? And if you don't respond to those questions, the court can strike your claim. So this was really initially just a dumbfounding ruling. Not only was it tacking on requirements that aren't in the statute, it was also ignoring the fact that the government's concern can be easily alleviated, even at the initial stages of litigation. I mean, one of the crazy things about this case and about civil forfeiture is that this money was seized in September of 2014. And here in March of 2019, we've just established that they've properly filed a claim. I mean, imagine if we were litigating over $5,000. At that point, it's just not worth it anymore.
No reasonable person is going to hire an attorney and spend 4 years to get $5,000 back?
Yeah, even if you're entirely innocent. And this is why we should not allow police and prosecutors to take property from people without even charging them with a crime.
One of the frustrating bits of this whole situation is that government often engages in this gotcha game where they try to make things more and more difficult and put up as many hurdles as they can for people who are trying to get constitutional rulings protecting their rights or trying to get their property back or whatever it is. And so, you know, in these forfeiture cases, there's a very small window for the property owner to stake a claim anyway. Often they're not represented by an attorney because they are not, you're not guaranteed a free attorney from the government like you are in criminal cases. And so these are people who are not necessarily sophisticated in the law who are forced to state a claim. And so they see what the rule says. The rule says you have to identify the claimant and state the claimant's interest in the property. So they do that. They say, I own this property, and that's that. But the previous Eighth Circuit decision in this case said that that wasn't sufficient, that you had to say where it came from, and so where your source of the money was. And so did you earn it as income, or was it a an inheritance from your grandfather or something like that? But that's just not what the rule says. And so now not only are people navigating these waters without an attorney, they're having to navigate case law without an attorney. And you're getting really to a point that it's just very almost impossible for just an average Joe to understand what he has to do.
Yeah. And, you know, in the litigation, you're going to get into that. It's not as though this person is just going to be able to make a bald assertion of ownership without ever having to justify it. I mean, I take it your point, Diana, is like, it doesn't need to be any harder. That's what the litigation was going to be about.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, the Eighth Circuit corrects its mistake, its shocking mistake.
Years later.
And with that, we can move on to the final case, which comes out of the Seventh Circuit. Diana?
So this last case that we're going to talk about today is a real doozy out of the Seventh Circuit called the Trustees of Indiana University v. Curry. And this case was brought on behalf of the Indiana University as well as Alzheimer's researchers who were employed by the university who use fetal tissue in their Alzheimer's research. And a few years back, the state of Indiana made it a felony for a person to intentionally acquire, receive, sell, or transfer fetal tissue. And so that fetal tissue was defined to include tissue, organs, or any other part of an aborted fetus. And so the district court ended up striking down parts of this law and narrowing it because the court found that the words acquires, receives, and transfers were too vague to be understood in this statute, as well as the phrase any other part when talking about the parts of the tissue that is defined as fetal tissue. And so on appeal, the Seventh Circuit basically said, nah, these words are fine. These words appear all over the place in criminal law and regulations and everything else. And if you can't interpret the word acquires, then we're all just like totally hosed.
Well, that sounds kind of reasonable.
It does initially, right? What the panel ultimately decides by a 2-to-1 vote is we will sort this out. We'll sort out the edge cases as people are prosecuted. And the dissent, I think, makes a good argument to the contrary that what you're really talking about is prospectively preventing people from doing this research. And right, Diana, doesn't the dissent go on at length about the importance of the research?
It does. And, you know, the dissent, I think, spends a lot of time really analyzing this case in the way that you kind of want an Article III judge to spend the time looking at the plaintiffs and the claims and the different representations that the attorneys for the different sides make. And the judge talks quite a bit about the kinds of the ways in which these researchers use fetal tissue to investigate and research Alzheimer's things. And so one of the things that they use tissue samples for, and this is something I didn't know about at all, but they're not necessarily using whole organs or anything like that, but they're taking tissue samples and then disassociating them, which allows the cells to grow and divide and then use for research for many, many years. And in fact, they have some of these cells that they're using were first cultured over 46 years ago. And so they can use this material for a long, long time. And, you know, you don't really get into that until – you don't get into that at all until you get to the dissent, which, like I said, spends a lot of time going through how these plaintiffs use this tissue, what the law does, you know, the ways in which the state attorneys asked for the laws to be interpreted to for it to be upheld.
Right. So one of the questions here, as the dissent points out, is the law says any part of fetal tissue. Well, is a cell that was divided from fetal tissue 40 some years ago still part of fetal tissue? Well, you know, the state attorneys were making all of these wild representations in the district court that, oh, no, don't worry about it. We'd never prosecute someone for that. And the dissent, I think, persuasively points out that, you know, while comforting for the time being, that's not what the statute says. And who knows what a future prosecutor might do.
And the majority, frustratingly, dodges the issue by basically saying that these plaintiffs should have brought the case in state court because state courts can issue these declaratory judgments that talk about whether or not the law could be used in such a way. Well, that's what the plaintiffs are asking the federal courts to do. And the federal courts are completely capable of doing this kind of work. That's what they've asked them to do. The court has jurisdiction. It's properly before them. And yet the majority just dodges it.
Right. Yeah, that frustrated me too. I mean, the Federal Declaratory Judgment Act also does that. So, you know, what the dissent describes this, I think, somewhat persuasively as a sort of veiled Pullman abstention. And for folks that don't know, that's the doctrine that says that federal courts really shouldn't, as a prudential matter, weigh in on unclear issues of state law. That does seem like what's going on here. Now the doctrine of vagueness sort of overlaps with that abstention doctrine. But as I hear you saying, Diana, it's kind of frustrating that they wouldn't just make a decision.
It's frustrating and yet not at all surprising. You know, as a constitutional litigator, you discover all of the different ways in which courts try to dodge the hard questions. For whatever reason, they don't always want to engage with the difficult questions, and so they find reasons not to. So in the forfeiture case we just talked about, for a while at least, it was the case in the Eighth Circuit that they didn't have to involve themselves with the merits of a forfeiture claim because the claimant didn't identify where it came from. That made it more difficult to get to the substantive issue at the heart of the case. And that's what the Seventh Circuit is essentially doing here. And that's what courts do often. And it's deeply frustrating as a litigator to have to deal with all of the reasons that the state will espouse and that sometimes the courts will espouse for why they don't have to get to the merits rather than having a difficult but correct and honest conversation about the merits of a case.
Well, my hunch here is that this one isn't over. I mean, the dissent from Judge Hamilton is just full of signals to Justice Gorsuch and others about the problems with the two-justice majority in this case. And my hunch is that we're going to see an en banc petition or a cert petition come out of this, maybe both.
Okay, that concludes the show. Thanks for tuning in. We appreciate you. Until next time, this is John Ross from the Institute for Justice, buttonholing you to get engaged.